From 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, 90.3 WFHE Hickory, this is Charlotte Talks. Sitting in for Mike Collins, I'm Chris Clackham. North Carolina filmmaker and author Kevin Duffus has been spending a lot of time in court lately because he's been trying to get some evidence, some very old evidence that may actually exonerate a crew member on the infamous pirate ship of the notorious Blackbeard the Pirate, who terrorized the waters off North Carolina's Outer Banks about 300 years ago. This crew member's name was Edward Salter, and his remains may be the ones discovered in a gravesite in Bath, North Carolina in 1986 and in possession today of the state of North Carolina. In short, it may be Edward Salter's bones in that box in the state archaeology office in Raleigh. And what Kevin Duffus is trying to do is to get DNA testing of those bones. That's why he's been in court lately, and he's been guided through the judicial system, the murky and the often terribly navigated waters of the judicial system, helped in this effort by Eric Groves, an attorney from Waxaw. Kevin, Eric, great to see you both. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Good morning.
How did the story get started, Kevin?
Well, Chris, I've sailed in the Caribbean in December, so I know what these weather conditions are like. They're probably on a somewhat squally December 5th day off the coast of Puerto Rico. A young man, probably about 21 years old, named Edward Salter, was minding his own business. He was the barrel maker or cooper aboard a sloop named the Margaret. And when the sun came up that morning, he probably had an idea of how he was going to spend the rest of the day, as did his captain. But when two large vessels appeared on the horizon, which turned out to be pirate ships, Edward Salter's fate was changed because the two ships were commanded by the notorious pirate Blackbeard, Edward Thatch. And Blackbeard detained the Margaret and interviewed the crew members and the captain and was purposely seeking someone with the skill to make barrels and casks, because Blackbeard had just a couple of weeks earlier had captured the ship that became the Queen Anne's Revenge and manned it with something like 400 pirates, and he was desperately in need of someone to make barrels. And so Edward Salter was forced aboard the Queen Anne's Revenge, and on that day Edward Salter became a pirate. And that's one of those moments that I see in history as a crossroads in time, because Edward Salter's destiny was shaped on that day, and everything that happened since as a result of Blackbeard in need of a cooper has caused quite a few things to happen, including the three of us sitting here talking about this right now, and your listeners on WFAE listening to this incredible story is all because of that event that happened in 1717.
Now, but what was Edward Salter's background? What was his lineage?
Well, prior to December 5th of 1717, we don't know. We know in a deposition, Edward Salter's captain, Henry Bostock, had said that Salter had sailed with another captain previously, but we don't know what port he held.
Was he from England?
Well, originally. I mean, his family presumably came from England, but he was 21 years old at the time. We don't know where they what his home port was, whether it was Charleston or Philadelphia or Barbados. I do know there were Salters living in Barbados in the late 1600s. There was a Henry Salter who lived in Charleston, and there's an intriguing possible connection between Henry Salter and the man who we believe maybe had been Blackbeard's father. But anyway, Edward Salter, we know he was a cooper, and he served aboard the Queen Anne's Revenge for the next year. In fact, for the next few months, that ship ranged across the breadth of the West Indies, and it was there was an interesting event where Blackbeard actually captured and burned a ship from New England because Boston had just executed some pirates, and he did that in retribution. He then stumbled into the port of Charleston, blockaded the entrance to the harbor of Charleston purely to acquire a chest of medicine. And then the next thing, of course, Blackbeard did was he crashed his great flagship 40-gun Queen Anne's Revenge at the entrance of Beaufort Inlet and dispersed his 400-man pirate crew, except for about 25 men, which he handpicked And for whatever reason, Edward Salter continued on with Blackbeard after that point. And that's how he entered. That's how we know that he came to North Carolina for the first time.
And you believe that here we are 275 years later, and that the remains, those bones that were found on the bank of the Bath River in Bath, North Carolina, are indeed the remains of Edward Salter.
Well, what happened was that Blackbeard came to North Carolina in June of 1718. He was not here very often. He left and was in and out of the colony, and at the most probably was here maybe 6 weeks. But he was captured and killed, Blackbeard was, at Ocracoke in November, on November 22nd of 1718. Six of his crew members were captured in Bath while Blackbeard had been killed at Ocracoke. These men, we have their names. The records are excellent in terms of identifying them. And along with the survivors, there were nine survivors taken at Ocracoke. All of these men were arrested, taken to Virginia, and put on trial.
15 men total, nine on board the ship, and six men on land at Bath, North Carolina.
Correct. And they were all charged with piracy. And according to traditional history, published history, the story is that these men were put on trial. Two were acquitted, and the remaining 13 were executed in Williamsburg. In fact, if you go to Williamsburg today, there's a wonderful interpretive sign at the old jail that says that on this spot, 13 of Blackbeard's crew members had been executed. Fortunately for Edward Salter, that's not what happened, because
he escaped execution that day.
Well, we can assume that because Edward Salter, a cooper, was in Bath, was arrested in Bath in November of 1718, and Edward Salter, a cooper, is in Bath in 1721, just 2 years later, purchasing property. He bought two half-acre lots in town. Now, some might say, well, that's not the same Edward Salter Cooper. There were two Edward Salter Coopers. But there are other intriguing clues that convince me that this was the same man. Now, this is really important because this is one of the chinks in the armor of established history. Well, everyone's been saying for so long that all of these men were executed. And the fact is that there are four or five other names of Blackbeard's crew members who also appear in the deeds, in the wills, and in the depositions of Bath for many years after their executions at Williamsburg. So we think that there's a very good explanation as to what happened to Edward Salter, why he escaped being hanged, and how he returned to Bath Creek.
All right, let's just back up real quick. Again, set the stage for us. It's the early 1700s. There are indeed pirates of the Caribbean who, during the warmer months, become the pirates of the East Coast of what would become the United States of America. They become the pirates of the Atlantic. Blackbeard is one of the most sinistered, most feared pirates traversing the waters of the Atlantic at this time.
Well, it's accurate to say that he was among the most feared. I don't know how sinister he was. I mean, there are a number of occasions where he captured ships and was very kind and respectful to other captains. There were other occasions, though, where he went on these rampages, whether they were drunken rampages or maybe fueled by some sort of medical problem. But, yes, Blackbeard operated from the Delaware Bay and was actually is recorded in the colonial records of Pennsylvania as walking the streets of Philadelphia.
Wow.
We know he was there. In fact, the records of Pennsylvania's colonial records state that Blackbeard had sailed as a first mate, prior to becoming a pirate, had sailed as a first mate out of Philadelphia. So he was very familiar with this the East Coast. Yes.
Okay. Distinguish the term privateer versus pirate. What's the difference?
Well, privateering was simply it was employed during wartime so that one nation could sort of expand the capabilities of their own navy by allowing civilian merchant vessels to raid enemy ships. And this was done by issuing a letter of marque. But the problem is that a lot of these guys that, you know, they participated in privateering didn't know when their own nations signed peace treaties with other nations. So they would actually think that they were privateering when they were actually had become pirates.
The reason why I bring that up is because an interesting distinction, because there is a possibility, is there not, that Blackbeard was operating under the wishes of the governor of North Carolina at that time.
Well, in my In my book, it's all purely, it is supposition. I admit that. But to me, the most logical explanation carries greater weight and scope than established history that makes no sense. And established history for 300 years has contradicted common sense. The conclusion I came to was, yes, these young men, they were very young. Blackbeard was probably about 27 or 28. Edward Salter was 21. I believe that they were dispatched by the governor of North Carolina, not to become pirates, but to go on a salvage mission to the coast of Florida to recover Spanish gold that had been spilled in a tremendous shipwreck of Spanish treasure ships.
Mm.
And so one thing led to another. But that's, again, that's hypothetical.
Okay, it's quite a quantum leap, though, to go from pirate to treasure hunter. You would agree with that, at least. Listen, before we get off of Edward Salter, though, too much, and the reason why I suggested that possibly Blackbeard was pretty sinister, because I thought that I read that had Edward Salter, for example, resisted in any way, he might have been killed by Blackbeard.
No, and there's no official record surviving, no primary source record that indicates that Blackbeard ever killed anybody or even threatened to kill anybody. He might have said once to a captain that things would have gone bad for you had you not surrendered. But the fact is that we don't know when these men were captured or pressed into service. Many times they winked and said, I don't want to go. I don't want to, board your pirate ship, when in fact they really did, because immediately their living conditions improved dramatically. They were suddenly going to be eating good food and they didn't have to work very hard. And so it's very possible that Edward Salter volunteered, but claimed to be pressed, just so if they ever were captured, he could say in court, it was against my will.
By law, Eric Groves, let's bring Eric in on the conversation at this particular point. Was Edward Salter kidnapped by Blackbeard and forced to be a member of his pirate ship crew?
Well, we don't know the answer to that question, but I think it's safe to say that he was certainly pressed into piracy. I don't think it was his desire that morning to board a pirate ship and change his fate, as Kevin mentioned earlier. I think that Blackbeard took him into his custody, so to speak, and forced him to be a pirate, and that's what ended up being the case.
And why were they taken to Williamsburg, Virginia, for execution? Nine crew members on board the ship when Blackbeard was finally confronted by the English captain, and the ship was destroyed, and the men were taken into custody, and the six men on land in Bath. But why were they taken all to Williamsburg, Virginia?
Well, that's a very interesting legal question that pertains to jurisdiction, and at the time there was a big dispute about it. Actually, the governor of Virginia at the time, Governor Spotswood, he was no friend of the pirates, as was perhaps Governor Eden in North Carolina, and he was the one who dispatched the team of British sailors to go to Bath and to collect these pirates, and he didn't have jurisdiction to do it.
Okay, we're going to take a break, on the other side of which we're going to talk about your attempt, Kevin Duffus, to get DNA from those bones sitting in a box in Raleigh. We're talking about a pirate's estate here on Charlotte Talks. We're back with more right after this.
Charlotte Talks continues in just a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 FM WFAE. Our programming made possible in part today by the Charlotte School of Law, presenting their Law Reviews Symposium on Land Use and Energy Generation with former Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham. February 26th, Booth Playhouse, charlottelaw.edu/lawreview. Well, coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, so you think the old Farmer's Almanac is just about farming and for farmers only? Well, think again. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, we'll meet the editor and publisher of the Almanac and find out what the best days are for cutting hair, quitting smoking, or going fishing, and why this year's the best year to view Jupiter. That and much more tomorrow on Charlotte Talks with guest host Chris Clackham. It's at 9 here on 90.7 FM WFAE.
Iran accelerates its nuclear program despite calls from the U.S. for new sanctions in weeks, not months. Iranian leaders vow to thwart expected protests, marking the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The Diane Rehm Show, Wednesday.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 FM WFAE.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham sitting in for Mike Collins. Our guests today include Kevin Duffus, the historical researcher, author of several books, including The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate. And that's our subject today, talking about a crew member on Blackbeard's ship, Edward Salter of Bath, North Carolina, the remains of which quite possibly are sitting in a box up in Raleigh, North Carolina last night. To this day, they were discovered in 1986.
That's correct.
Yeah. And what were the circumstances under which they were discovered?
Well, I guess we need to fill in the what happened to Edward Salter after he was supposedly hanged in Williamsburg. But he appears, the deed book of Beaufort County is very clear that in 1721, just 2 years later, he purchased two lots. And then a couple of years after that, Edward Salter, this lowly cooper, purchased the governor's former 400-acre plantation and palace on Bath Creek. So within 6 years of having been a pirate, he was sleeping in the governor's former bedroom. Then, of course, he didn't stop there. He purchased something like 600 acres of land upon which the town of Washington is built today on the Pamlico River, and then added another 3,300 acres of waterfront timberland. Now, this was all in a very short amount of time, and it begs the question, where did Edward Salter's newfound wealth come from?
Okay, right. That was going to be my next question. Do you suspect that it came from the booty that he got, the bounty that he shared in with Blackbeard the Pirate?
Well, it's curious that when Blackbeard was killed at Ocracoke, Lieutenant Maynard, who was in charge of that operation, spent 2 weeks there searching the island and Blackbeard's possessions for his treasure and never found anything. And then you go a couple years into the future and you see some of these crew members who survived are suddenly wealthy, and including Blackbeard's former quartermaster, William Howard, who came within something like 12 hours of being hanged himself, but a pardon arrived on the night before his scheduled execution. William Howard later, about 25 years later, bought the entire island of Ocracoke.
Mm.
So these guys had money. Some were a little more circumspect, and others, and how they displayed their wealth. But Edward Salter became one of the largest landowners in eastern North Carolina during the colonial times. And when he died in 1735, it was January of 1735. In fact, we just passed the 275th anniversary. He was buried on his estate on the west bank of Bath Creek, and it's a very well documented location. And he was the only owner that we know of who died while owning that property. Now, his family continued to own it for another 20 or 30 years until 1759, and then the property changed hands. But Edward Salter's burial was there, on a very beautiful bluff overlooking the creek. Well, eventually that property became farmland and was tilled. Even to this day, it alternates between corn in the summer and soybeans, and plows have gone back and forth across that field, not knowing that below the soil, the surface there, was the foundation of Governor Eden's former palace and the grave of Edward Salter. And it was in 1986 that the owners of the property wanted to construct a bulkhead to prevent the shoreline from eroding into Bath Creek, and they applied for a permit from the Corps of Engineers and to do that. It was a known cultural site, so the Office of State Archaeology was called in to do an investigation, and it was in the course of that investigation that they encountered this crypt, and the crypt was excavated. And there were human remains inside that were removed, and those are the human remains that we're discussing today, the suspected remains of Edward Salter.
Those are the remains that, again, a set of bones that are in boxes in Raleigh.
They have remained in storage, and they have been conserved permanently in the State Archaeology Research Center and have been for now 23 years.
24 almost.
24 years.
Yeah, 24 years. Now, for our listeners, if you want to follow along with what Kevin Duffus is talking about here. Down in, that's Beaufort County?
Yes, it is.
Bath, North Carolina, and the story of Edward Salter, a crew member on Blackbeard, the pirate ship. You can visit our website, see the images of Edward Salter's plot of land and where his remains were found. All you got to do is just go to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're also joined by Eric Groves, an attorney from Waxhaw, who's been helping Kevin Duffus navigate the judicial system in trying to get what, Eric? What are you guys, what's your objective by going to court here?
Well, our objective is to have the bones returned to Bath and to be reinterred there in Beaufort County in a very solemn, dignified way. And the problem was, obviously, after so many years, how do you go about doing something like that?
Mm.
And that's been basically what we've been struggling for the past year.
But also, is there DNA testing that you're part of the objective here?
Well, over 2 years ago, I began raising the question of whether DNA testing would help us determine the identity of the remains. The state has said that they had stated that the identity of the remains was uncertain. And I actually very diligently scoured the entire country looking for possible descendants of Edward Salter and have found quite a few people who believe they are related to him. But to be able to prove the identity of the remains, not necessarily, DNA is not going to tell us that those bones are Edward Salter. All they're going to do is tell us that they are an ancestor of people that we believe are descended from Edward Salter. But I've been asking for DNA testing, and for various reasons, our requests have been denied.
And speaking of the descendants of Edward Salter, some of whom are living today and are joining you in your request, in your petition of the court. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. This would be Brian Blunt. He's from Rogersville, Missouri, and he has come forward as a lineal descendant of Edward Salter, and we're representing him also in this court case, which is, I think, going very well.
I think Edward Salter would want me to say on his behalf that he was very proud of his family. He had one son and four daughters, but that son produced a family with quite a few children, and this family intermarried with many members of the Blunt family, which is a very prominent family in North Carolina. One of the Blunts was a signer of the U.S. Constitution, for example. And this was a very proud and public-minded family that served our nation in many, many ways during the American Revolution, for example. And then they dispersed. They went to some of them moved into South Carolina and to Alabama and worked their way into Louisiana, and others went to Missouri. And so there are descendants in many, many locations. But the one that we're really focusing on, Brian Blunt, we have a very certain and unbroken lineal or line of descent from him to Edward Salter.
And speaking of the law at this particular point, the discovery made by the company that wanted to build the bulkhead on what was Edward Salter's property on the Bath River in Bath, North Carolina. It is part of North Carolina state law that anytime anyone finds remains of anybody under any circumstances, that there must be a posting of notices, a petition of notices, to see whether or not the descendants want, walk us through that, Eric, if you could.
Well, that's Article 3 of Chapter 70, and that deals with the discovery of unmarked burial graves or burial crypts.
Yes.
And one of the things that that has to happen is, of course, you know, when someone finds an unmarked burial grave, burial crypt, the state of North Carolina has to be contacted, and they can exhume the body, but there is a process that the state has to go through, including giving notice in the newspaper in the county in which the discovery is made, that they've made this discovery, and that they give the opportunity to the folks there in the county to come forward and identify the remains, or that they are next of kin of that person who they've discovered.
And the reason why I bring it up at this particular point, because here we are 24 years after the state discovered these bones in that crypt in near Bath, North Carolina. And come to find out, the state never did the advertising posting of the petition that they're required by law to do.
Well, that's true. They, for some reason, they neglected to do that. And the Judge Sermons down in Beaufort County just recently, in his most recent order, has ordered the state of North Carolina to actually post that notice and give the 4 weeks of required notice opportunity for folks to come forward and to say whether they, you know who this person is that's buried or that they're descendants of that person. And that's what has just recently expired, is that 4 week period.
And in fact, there was some posting in newspapers in the eastern part of the state just last week.
Right. That's correct. Yep.
I think this is one of the interesting aspects of this case is that every day in North Carolina, because of development, the construction of roads or shopping centers, retail stores, unmarked burials are being found or encountered, and there are situations where cemeteries have to be moved. And there are many cases where these are abandoned cemeteries. And you know, unfortunately, when we are – every society in history has afforded its dead with great respect. I don't know of a time or a place where people just toss their ancestors, you know, haphazardly into a landfill. We always – very dutifully bury our dead. Mm-hmm. And you would think that this, the solemn interment of the dead would be permanent, but unfortunately it's not. So at another level, we're sort of fighting for the rights of the dead. And whether it's right to dig somebody up and then put them in a box and ship them off to some university somewhere for, I certainly respect the need for scientific testing and for the advances that can come from that. But to simply put someone's bones in a box and leave them on a shelf when there are living family members who would like to see that person reinterred, I think that's something we need
and
to pay
speaking
attention.
Of reinterred and of Edward Salter, he was one of the founding members of the oldest brick church that remains standing to this day in Bath.
Well, the Church of England had a parish dating to the early 1700s in eastern North Carolina, and in the Beaufort County area, it was called St. Thomas Parish. Now, the parishioners met every Sunday in various homes, but they wanted their own sanctuary. And in 1734, in fact, it was October of 1734, this same Edward Salter, who, whether or not he had been a pirate or not, let's just say we don't know, but we do know that this historical Edward Salter, in October 1734, sent a letter to the Bishop of London saying that we have begun, at our own proper expense, we're paying for this ourselves, construction of our church, St. Thomas Church. He was a warden, one of two wardens for the church. So his own money went to the expense of laying the foundation of bricks to build that church. Well, that church is North Carolina's oldest standing brick church. And just this past Sunday, services were held every week. Services are continue to be held in that sanctuary that Edward Salter helped to build. Now, that church did not exist in 1735 when Edward Salter died. We're certain that he would have wanted to have been buried in the church, the sanctified ground of that churchyard, but instead he was buried in his backyard. Well, it seems right, thinking about the desires of Edward Salter, that he, if he were to be reinterred, that would be where he would be reinterred. So,
do I detect, though, some hesitancy in your voice about whether or not this is indeed Edward Salter who was on Blackbeard's ship?
There's no hesitancy in my voice at all. I just said that for those scholars and academics out there who'd like to see a solid chain of evidence. No, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, and here's a reason. In beginning my research for the book on Blackbeard, I begin with my search for the grave of Blackbeard's sister. Eastern North Carolina legend has always told this story about this woman named Susanna White, or Susie White, who was Blackbeard's sister. When I was a teenager, I set out to find her grave. Well, I found it. And I was so excited to be standing at the grave of Blackbeard's sister, and then I started reading the gravestone and discovered that this woman was born 37 years after Blackbeard was killed, and it was no possible way that she could have been Blackbeard's sister. Well, it was through research for this book that I discovered that, no, she wasn't Blackbeard's sister, but she was, in fact, Edward Salter's granddaughter.
Mm.
And for 200 years, legend has attached her name to piracy. Well, it was through her grandfather, not through Blackbeard himself. And that's why I believe this is the same Edward Salter. This is a circumstantial evidence, of course, but it's much more powerful than the traditional established versions of the story.
Okay. I like to say that there's no smoking flintlock, but certainly all of the evidence seems to point to the fact that this is Edward Salter, and that Edward Salter was somehow, has some connection with Blackbeard.
If you'd like to join our discussion about Edward Salter and his estate in Bath, North Carolina, our telephone numbers are 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323 or 1-800-603-9323. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is our email address. Before we, and again, as all part of the line of connection that this Edward Salter was the same one on Blackbeard's ship. Before I get too far away from it, how did he escape execution in Williamsburg, Virginia in 1719?
Well, what we believe happened was that literally at the last moment, or fairly close to the last moment, a second pardon from the king came, and I'm going to let Kevin speak more to that because he knows more of the history, but this came at the very last moment.
Okay. Kevin?
Well, here's what happened. England was about to declare war on Spain. This was after a peace treaty had been signed with Spain, and then they decided to go back and fight again. And the King of England needed to beef up his forces. And so there were something like 2,000 or 3,000 men who were pirates, and he thought, well, I need to get these guys to come back to an honest life so that they can fight on our behalf. So he issued a pardon to pirates, and he issued the initial pardon, said that if you surrender by a certain time, I'll forgive you for any piracies that you've committed prior to a certain date. Well, that didn't work so well. A number of these guys surrendered. They took the king's pardon, then they went out and committed piracies again. So the king's privy council, advised him to issue a second pardon. And the second pardon was worded completely differently. It said that if you surrender, you'll be forgiven for any piracies committed prior to your surrender. Well, that meant that, I could commit a piracy and then go in and surrender. Well, this second proclamation arrived, unfortunately for Blackbeard, 2 weeks after he was killed at Ocracoke. In fact, I think the reason why he was lingering there so late in the season, I mean, most pirates worth their salt would have been down in the warm weather of the Caribbean. So this pardon that arrived saved Edward Salter's life and didn't arrive soon enough to save Blackbeard's life.
And Edward Salter returned to Bath, North Carolina, took up residence there, and we're going to discuss more about this, A Pirate's Estate, with Kevin Duffus, author and of the book The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pilot, as well as Eric Groves, an attorney from Waxhaw, right after this.
The conversation continues in just a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 FM WFAE. Our programming made possible in part today by Heartwood Tree Service, now performing seasonal research-based pruning by certified arborists on dormant trees to increase storm safety and vigor. Information at 704-525-3066 or heartwoodtree.com. A conversation about Iran next on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes. Iran accelerates its nuclear program despite calls from the U.S. for new sanctions in weeks, not months. Iranian leaders vow to thwart expected protests marking the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Conversation at 10 here on 90.7 FM WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation today, call 704-926-WFAE or 1-800-603-WFAE. Or you can email us by going to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Staying connected to the news on WFAE has never been more important or more expensive. Help keep Charlotte's NPR news station on your radio by making a pledge right now. You'll be entered to win an Apple MacBook and an iPod Touch. Just go to WFAE.org and make your contribution. No pledge is necessary to enter the contest, but we hope you'll choose to support your trusted source for news, WFAE and NPR.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. We're talking about a pirate's estate down in Beaufort County, North Carolina, Bath, North Carolina, the estate of Edward Salter, the remains of which probably sit in a box in Raleigh, North Carolina. Kevin Duffus, author, historical researcher, author of the book The Last Days of Blackbeard, the Pirate, is joining us, as well as Eric Groves, his attorney from Waxaw, who's been helping navigate the judicial system to try to get access to those bones and to get them reinterred at St. Thomas Church in Bath, North Carolina, later this year.
That's the outcome that we would like to see eventually, yes.
And then what else would you like to accomplish? What is your objective here?
Well, there's been some discussion as to whether there should be, when the bones were disinterred in 1986, they were sent to Wake Forest University, where a forensic anthropologist did a complete examination analysis of the bones and discovered, you know, as much as could be determined in 1986 with technology and science at the time. Since then, of course, more recently, now there's a great deal of interest in these bones, and there have been suggestions that other types of testing be done, some tests to determine, for example, what sort of food this gentleman might have eaten, or possibly doing facial reconstruction, which is the latest fad, I guess, or craze among archaeology today. I just read a story about the facial reconstruction of King Tut, I think, was done a couple years ago, and now Italian archaeologists want to dig up Leonardo da Vinci's remains so that they can reconstruct his face and to see whether, you know, the face of the Mona Lisa was actually his. So there have been suggestions that facial reconstruction be done, but facial reconstruction is still fairly subjective and is open to wide interpretation. And it's not, we don't have a photograph of the pirate Edward Salter, so it's not going to tell us, you know, what he actually looked like. It's just something to do. So we would just, you know, Edward Salter did not want to have all these things happen to him. He wanted to be buried. In fact, I'm holding a copy of his will right here, and he said, I wish to be decently interred. And I'm sure when his family put him in the ground that they thought that was the end of it.
Mm.
And so I don't think it was Edward Salter's wish to be facially reconstructed or to have his bones or even to have the DNA testing done. The only problem with DNA, of course, again, is the no DNA test is going to tell us that those bones are Edward Salter. However, from the preponderance of evidence, including even the state's own researchers in 1986 concluded that these bones were Edward Salter. It's the historical evidence and the fact that his right arm bone was very obvious to the forensic anthropologist was robust and depicted someone who had done a manual labor in their lifetime, like a cooper.
Yeah, a cooper being a barrel maker?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
So we think there's plenty of evidence to conclude that the bones are Edward Salter. It's funny that the folks with the Queen Anne's Revenge Project, of course, you know, often say in interviews that they have a preponderance of circumstantial evidence that tell us that the ship in Beaufort Inlet that they've been excavating is the Queen Anne's Revenge, but they have absolutely no certain proof. Well, you know, that we're saying the same thing with Edward Salter. There really is no doubt that this is who it is.
And this is the man whose ancestors went on to become very, very influential members of what would be American society.
Well, Edward Salter III, his grandson, was a delegate to the convention that ratified the Halifax Resolves, which was the document which inspired the Declaration of Independence later that year in 1776. Another grandson was leading tax revolts. He was the sheriff of Pitt County, but he was actually refusing to collect taxes. I mean, this was a very heroic family who served North Carolina well.
And another grandson that went on to become a three-term governor of Tennessee?
Yes, that's correct. Wiley Salter Blunt, was Edward Salter's grandson, and he served as a three-term governor.
Okay, so where do we stand right now with a court case to get access to these remains, Eric?
Well, the judge just recently, in his most recent order, he required the state of North Carolina to provide this notice period and to receive notices from the public as to the identity of the remains or those persons that they believe are descendants of Edward Salter. And we're waiting for that notice period to end. It just recently ended. And I think that the next step, and I've spoken with my opposing counsel, Karen Blum, at the North Carolina Attorney General's office, they're preparing a proposal of the things that the Department of Cultural Resources would like to do vis-a-vis the bones. But the good thing about Chapter 70 is that it allows the next of kin to sort of be in charge of that process. And I think that's very important, that the next of kin who come forward who can show that they're, you know, related to this Edward Salter are going to have a big say in what happens, how that goes about, and what ultimately happens, what the ultimate disposition of the bones is.
Kevin Duffus, you have turned the world of the history of piracy on the East Coast of what would become the United States of America. You've turned that world inside out. You've been annoyed by the inaccuracies that have stood for close to 250, 275 years now. Are you meeting resistance right now with the case of Edward Salter?
Well, I would say that there are people who are unwilling to accept theories that are formed by someone who doesn't have PhD at the end of their name. And the fact is that their history has always given great weight to published works and established history that has been around for a long time. You know, most of what we know about Blackbeard and Edward Salter and his pirate crew is based on a book that was written in 1724. But nobody really knows where the information came from for that book. And no one's ever challenged it really responsibly. The fact is that there are many, many errors in pirate history. And then, you know, when there are gaps in the story, of course, we allow folklore and myth to sort of fill in those spaces. And now Hollywood, of course, tells us what we're supposed to know about pirates. And that's – pirates were not the people that we think they were. And in many cases, many of these men – they were pirates for a few months or a year, but then they went back and contributed to society and lived normal lives. So I do think it was an interesting time in American history, but it's not been really fully explored and researched and understood.
For a couple of centuries, we believed his name to be Edward Teach, did we not?
Well, that's the most common description of his name was Teach, but it was, if you look, I've got copies of the original documents, the sources right here, and it's always spelled as Thatch.
Thatch.
But even the word Thatch would not have been pronounced Thatch in 1718. It would have been pronounced Tatch or Tetch. So you can see how Tetch would have maybe become Teach. It wasn't until what Samuel Johnson sort of devised the very first dictionary. It was something like 30 or 40 years after Blackbeard was killed. But there was no standardized spelling. So all of these words were spelled, you know, Governor Spotswood spelled Blackbeard's name four different ways in the same letter. So you can see how there would be confusion.
Yeah, speaking of which, David wrote on our website, he's asking this question, have you done any research in Perkiomen's County? If so, what did you find there? He said he has found some Thatches who live there still with intriguing stories about the subject.
Perkiomen's County, yes. I am aware. I did some searches of where all the Thatches live today. I think actually Thatch was derived from Thatcher. And as far as I'm concerned, I think even Thatch wasn't Blackbeard's real name. And we don't have time to go into those theories of who I think Blackbeard really was. But the fact is that I believe the Thatch name came from Philadelphia. There was a well-established family of Thatchers living on near the Philadelphia waterfront in 1715 to 1718. So I don't think that Blackbeard came from Perkiomen's County. Of course, everybody in eastern North Carolina wants to be related to Blackbeard somehow. Every day I encounter people who say that they're, you know, a distant cousin of Blackbeard's. And, of course, everybody also wants to know where he buried his treasure.
But was he I think you addressed this in your book that came out in, May 2008?
That's correct.
The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate.
Correct.
Do you doubt that he was an Englishman?
I do, actually. I think that his family probably came out of Scotland during the Covenanter uprisings in the mid 17th century, and were probably, I think their path here went through Barbados. They were probably indentured servants on the island of Barbados, and then eventually emigrated to Charleston. I actually believe, and I propose this theory in my book, that Blackbeard himself was born around 1690 in Charleston, or just on the outside of Charleston, the Goose Creek area.
Blackbeard the pirate.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Your support, though, for your present-day endeavor as it relates to Edward Salter's estate in Bath, you're receiving some support for that in your effort from the town of Bath itself.
Well, not just from the town of Bath, but also the county. The county commissioners have passed a resolution in support of doing DNA testing or whatever's necessary. They want to bring the bones of this man returned to Beaufort County. Regardless of whether he had been a pirate or not, Edward Salter was a significant figure in eastern North Carolina history. He's the type of person that they should build or erect a historical marker on the side of the highway saying Edward Salter, you know, once lived near here, and these are the reasons why we should remember him. And so, yes, Beaufort County is very enthusiastic, and we're also discussing the possibility of reinterring Edward Salter's remains if this were to ever happen at St. Thomas Church, the church that he helped to build.
What gives you the confidence, though, you addressed it earlier in the program, that this is indeed the Edward Salter one and the same, that this is not a different Edward Salter?
Well, there's no question that the bones that are in a box at the archaeologist's office in Raleigh are the bones that were removed, disinterred from a crypt on property owned by Edward Salter at the time of his death. There's no question that the bones depict are of a man who did manual labor with his right arm and shoulder. We know that Edward Salter was a cooper. So we know these bones came from Bath Creek, and could they be someone else buried on Edward Salter's property who also had a robust right arm and shoulder? Well, there is that possibility.
And this was a very, I want to jump in and say, this was a very ornate crypt. It was not like someone who was a commoner. Mm. And Edward Salter, when he died, was apparently quite wealthy. And you would expect a man like him to have a crypt of that nature.
Is the law on your side at this particular point, Eric Groves? The law is on your side. You would contend that if it is the wishes of the descendants of Edward Salter, if they want him returned to Bath as opposed to sitting in a box in Raleigh.
That's correct.
The descendants are going to get their way.
But the law is on Edward Salter's side and the family side is what, yeah. Not on our side. But
well, exactly. I mean, the law, I think, is designed to support the wishes of the next of kin, and the next of kin will ultimately have the last say in this matter. And that's the way it should be.
And as we have addressed before, the next of kin at this particular point remain the Blounts of Missouri.
That's right. Now, I'm aware that some others have come forward. I don't know who they are.
The state archaeologist, Steve Claggett, I think is his name, has stated that he's received 10 responses to the notices in the newspaper that have been appearing over the last month.
Fewer than 10.
Yeah,
I think
fewer than 10. We don't know who those people are, but they're going to come forward and they're going to make their claim, and we'll see what happens next.
The fact is there are probably thousands of people that are related to Edward Salter. As I said, there was a very prominent family that moved into Alabama and then eventually to Louisiana and Texas. A lot of genealogical work still needs to be done, but we do have, you know, one family that we're very certain of. But the law is also on the side of the state archaeologist in that state law gives them the right to permanently conserve human remains that are removed from an unmarked burial if no next of kin can be located. Now, it's very possible that they could say, well, we don't know any of these people are the next of kin of these bones because we don't know who these bones are.
Mm.
So it's
a little bit of an obstacle, to say the least, at this particular point. Brian writes in, asking on our Facebook page, is Salter's path close to Emerald Isle in Atlantic Beach named after Edward Salter? We're talking about his legacy. And
there is a large family of Salters living in the Carteret County area, also Craven County, and there is some reason to believe that they are related to the same Salter family from Beaufort County. But that's not been proven yet. But the name Salter Path came much, much later. We're talking probably late 19th century, 1800s, that the Salter Path area got its name. But it was certainly named for a man named Salter who used it to go. It was sort of a haul over point between the Sound, Bogue Sound, and the ocean.
And there's been, you know, Beaufort County and the mayor of Bath have not been shy about the fact that they would like for all of this to occur, that you have a proper burial site in Bath, North Carolina, possibly the only grave site for any pirate anywhere in the world, well, as an attraction.
Well, a well-known archaeologist and author, Charles Ewan of East Carolina University, has agreed with me. I was the one to say, well, we don't know of any other identifiable pirate remains in history, period. It's been estimated something like 4,000 men and about a half a dozen women were pirates. All of those burials, all of those people have vanished, except for Edward Salter. He's the only one left.
Kevin Duffus, North Carolina historical researcher, author of the book The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate. Eric Groves, an attorney from Waxaw, helping Mr. Duffus go through the court system here to find out the true identity on those bones in Raleigh, North Carolina, which they believe are, in fact, Edward Salter of Bath, North Carolina. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you.
I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. You've been listening to Charlotte Talks on listener-funded public radio, WFAE.